So turn again in your Bibles, please, to 2 Kings chapter 19 as we continue our series in this Old Testament book. And hearing features a lot in this passage. 12 times we have the actual verb, heard or hear. And then on top of that, the organ necessary for hearing, the ear, it's mentioned twice. So hearing, as I say, features a lot. And it features in different ways at different stages of the narrative. And that being so, then, I have for you this evening four headings. And first of all, a hearing that's supernaturally arranged. That's the first thing we're going to consider. A hearing that's supernaturally arranged. So the first reference to hearing occurs in the very opening verse. As soon as King Hezekiah heard it, the chapter begins. And if you weren't here last time, or if you were here but your memory doesn't reach back that far, that line won't mean much to you. As soon as King Hezekiah heard what, you'll be wondering. Well, in chapter 18, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, has issued a stark challenge to Jerusalem. Basically, surrender or be conquered. Those are the two alternatives that he has set before them. And it's that then, Sennacherib's challenge, that verse 1 of our passage is talking about as soon as King Hezekiah heard it. And what this hearing of the challenge immediately prompted Hezekiah to do, verses 1 to 4, tell us. In the first place, the king gave visible expression to his dismay. He tore his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth, we read in verse 1. And then, having done that, secondly, he sent a message to the prophet Isaiah. And his message to the prophet Isaiah doesn't go unanswered. In verses 6 and 7, we have the prophet's response. He begins by urging Hezekiah not to be afraid on account of Sennacherib's intimidation. And he then goes on in verse 7 to explain why Hezekiah needn't be afraid. The explanation is a three-part prophecy, and the first part is this. Behold, verse 7, I will put a spirit in him so that he shall hear a rumor. Sennacherib is going to hear a rumor. And we don't have to wait long for this to be fulfilled. Just two verses later, verse 9. Now the king, that's King Sennacherib, king of Assyria, heard concerning Tirhaka, king of Cush. Behold, he has set out to fight against you. So that's the rumor that Sennacherib hears, that an enemy is advancing against him. Now, this raises interesting questions. For one thing, how is Sennacherib hearing that rumor useful to Hezekiah? That's how it's presented in verse 7, isn't it? Hezekiah doesn't need to be afraid. And one of the reasons he doesn't need to be afraid is that Sennacherib is going to hear this rumor. So how exactly does that help then? Well, park that question for just now. We'll come to it later. But then for another thing, is the rumor true? Is Tirhaka, king of Cush, advancing against Sennacherib? Well, we don't know the answer to that. It depends in part on how we understand this spirit that's referred to at the beginning of verse 7. To me, the language of God putting a spirit inside someone sounds like more than just making someone think in a certain way. It sounds as though an intelligent being, a spirit in that sense, is being sent here by God into someone. And given that not long ago, back in 1 Kings chapter 22, God had sent a lying spirit into a whole load of Ahab's prophets, some of you will remember that story, I'm sure. I think it's quite likely that the same thing is going on here. It's a lying spirit that God puts in Sennacherib, in which case the rumor isn't true. The king of Cush, Tirhaka, isn't on the warpath against Sennacherib at all. But whether or not I'm right about that, we're clearly meant to understand that Sennacherib wouldn't have heard of this threat from Tahaka. Perhaps it doesn't exist, and that's why he wouldn't have heard of it. That, as I say, is my hunch. Or perhaps it's a stealth mission or something by the king of Kush, and that's why he wouldn't have heard of it. But either way, he wouldn't have heard about it. But God caused him to hear of it. If the threat doesn't exist, he caused him to hear of it by means of a lying spirit. If the threat does exist, then this spirit which God puts in Sennacherib presumably refers to some kind of special awareness. But the point is, God caused him to hear of it. God caused him to hear of it. And that's what I mean then by my heading, a hearing that's supernaturally arranged. God is behind what Sennacherib hears regarding Tahaka. The rumor doesn't just happen to enter the king of Assyria's ears. It does so by God's deliberate and direct arrangement. That's what the text is saying. Which demonstrates rather emphatically, does it not, God's control over the most powerful figures on this planet. Do you remember how that challenge to Jerusalem, surrender or be conquered, it wasn't issued, was it, by Sennacherib in person? Instead, it was issued by those guys with fancy titles representing Sennacherib and speaking on his behalf. And that kind of thing created a certain mystique, you see. An impressive sense of inaccessibility. You didn't come into contact with the king of Assyria. Ordinary people didn't come into contact with him. You didn't get near him. You didn't have any access to him, this remote emperor who operates through his Rabshakeh. But verse 7 here is saying God can get near him. God has access to him. God has access indeed right into his head. Regulating what Sennacherib hears, regulating what Sennacherib understands to be happening. The Assyrian king can't keep himself impressively remote from God. He can't surround himself with some kind of mystique in relation to Yahweh. And the same is true of those who exercise power and influence in our world today. However many gates they may live behind, however many agents they may have representing them, however carefully choreographed their public appearances may be, God has access to their thoughts, to their plans, to their very dreams as they sleep at night, no less. All such areas are entirely open to him. He can implant ideas. He can steer mental processes entirely as he pleases. No region of these people's hearts and heads are off limit to him. Isn't that something? Isn't that an extraordinary degree of sovereign control that we are talking about? It should comfort us this evening. Our God reigns. And what is going on in the minds of significant and formidable actors on the stage of history, even that does not lie outside his reign. Truly, comprehensively, unambiguously, our God reigns. So that's the first thing this evening, a hearing that's supernaturally arranged. But then secondly, notice with me, a hearing that's surprisingly affirmed. A hearing that's surprisingly affirmed. Now in verses 15 to 19, Hezekiah prays. Just after that, there's another message to him from Isaiah. And it begins, verse 20, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, your prayer to me." So this is Isaiah's, or God's message to Hezekiah through Isaiah. "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, your prayer to me about Sennacherib, king of Assyria, I have heard." So that's the affirmation to which my second heading refers. God affirms through Isaiah that he has heard Hezekiah's prayer. And the fact God gives this affirmation then creates the impression, doesn't it, that Hezekiah's prayer is important. Hezekiah has asked. Save us, please, verse 19. That is, save us from the king of Assyria who is threatening us so. And sure enough, God is going to save Jerusalem then, because he has heard this request. He has heard Hezekiah's prayer, save us, please. That's the impression you get from the affirmation in verse 20. Hezekiah has asked that they be saved. God has heard, and so they're going to be saved. But as my heading indicates then, that's surprising. And it's surprising for this reason. Back in Isaiah's first message to Hezekiah in verses 6 and 7, back there, it's already been promised that Jerusalem is going to be saved. Okay, not in exactly those words, but that's the gist, isn't it, of verse 7. That's why in verse 6, as we've already seen, Hezekiah is told he doesn't need to be afraid, because God is going to save his people. He's going to save Jerusalem. And so if God has already promised to save Jerusalem in verses 6 and 7, then surely Hezekiah's subsequent prayer in verses 15 to 19 isn't important at all. It's irrelevant, really. It's redundant. Hezekiah is needlessly asking for something that's guaranteed anyway on the basis of the promise in verses 6 and 7. That would seem a logical way of thinking. But it must be a wrong way of thinking, because we can't just sweep this robust affirmation of verse 20 under the carpet and pretend it isn't there. It is there. It's in black and white. This attributing of the forthcoming deliverance from Sennacherib to Hezekiah's prayer. For all that the deliverance was promised, the prayer was clearly still crucial. In fact, there's something interesting here. I asked the question earlier, how is Sennacherib hearing that rumor about an advancing enemy useful? You get the impression, of course, from verse 7, that it's going to send the Assyrian king back to his homeland. He'll hear the rumor and he'll go back to his homeland. But that's actually not the case. You'll be familiar, some of you, with the concept of blurred horizons in Old Testament prophecies. It's usually when Old Testament prophets are foretelling events in the distant future. Usually, indeed, how salvation is going to unfold through the Messiah. And in one passage, then, a prophet will talk about events which we now know were associated with the Messiah's first coming. And also, he'll talk about events which we now know are associated with the Messiah's second coming. But in the prophecy, there's no sense of time gap. The different chronological horizons are blurred. And in verse 7, actually, we have that phenomenon. Even though Isaiah is actually foretelling three events that are going to occur in the relatively near future, Sennacherib hearing a rumor, Sennacherib returning to his homeland, and Sennacherib falling by the sword. The prophecy makes them sound, doesn't it, as though one just leads to the next in rapid and logical succession. But that's because the horizons, I'm saying, have been blurred. Chronological gaps, which in fact separate these three events, have been collapsed in the prophecy. Because Sennacherib's return to his own land has nothing to do with the rumor he hears about the king of Cush advancing. It's later on in verse 36, almost at the end of the passage, that Sennacherib departs and goes home and lives in Nineveh. And that's triggered by something completely different, not by the rumor of the king of Cush at all. So if the rumor doesn't send Sennacherib back to his own land, then what on earth is the point of it? How does it perform any useful function here? Well, because Sennacherib has to delay things slightly in order to check out the rumor, he sends a letter to Hezekiah just to let Judah's king know that this temporary diversion doesn't fundamentally alter the situation. The challenge that he has issued to Jerusalem remains the same. But something about receiving the letter, perhaps its tangibility and its spreadableness indeed, verse 14. It somehow acts as a stimulus to Hezekiah to go into the house of the Lord and to pray. And that then seems to be the reason for the whole rumor thing. Without the rumor, there would have been no letter, and without the letter, there would have been no prayer from Hezekiah. Yes, he's requested prayer earlier on from Isaiah, but he seemed reluctant to pray himself. It's only when the letter comes, the letter, for some reason, seems to be the thing that gets Hezekiah on his knees. In other words, Hezekiah's prayer, "Save us, please," despite the already existing promise of salvation, it's so important in God's eyes, it has such a crucial role in his sending salvation here, that God devises this convoluted process, putting a rumor in Sennacherib's mind to ensure that the prayer of Hezekiah will happen. And there's a principle here then, which is this. God doesn't do things merely because he has promised them. We love as evangelicals to emphasize the promises of God, and rightly so. But perhaps in our emphasis on that, we can overlook this. God doesn't do things merely because he has promised them. No, he does things because his people, impelled by his promises, have prayed for them. That was the case with the first coming of Christ. It didn't occur merely because of Genesis 3:15 and Micah 5 and all those other promises that we'll be revisiting, no doubt, in a few weeks' time. It occurred because people like Anna and Simeon and others, impelled by the promises, were praying for the redemption of Jerusalem, as it's put, praying for the Messiah. It will be the case with the second coming of Christ as well. God will cause it to happen in response to his people's promise-animated prayers. It's the case with the growth of Christ's kingdom now, throughout this present age. It's promised, but God brings it about in response to the prayers impelled by the promises. All of which challenges us this evening. Are we praying? Very simple question, isn't it? But perhaps a searching one nonetheless. Are we praying? Are we praying privately? Are we praying corporately? Prayer is not a silly game that we play as God just gets on and fulfills his promises anyway. No, prayer has a crucial role in the fulfillment of God's promises. It's a vital component in the process. It's why God will sometimes go to great lengths to drive us to our knees, as he goes to great lengths here with Hezekiah, a whole complicated process of events. Prayer has a crucial role in the fulfillment of God's promises. So, we've noticed two things this evening: a hearing that's supernaturally arranged, and a hearing that's surprisingly affirmed. But then notice with me, thirdly, a hearing that's supremely assuring. A hearing that's supremely assuring. So notice then in verse 4, when Hezekiah is sending his original message to Isaiah, he expresses the hope, doesn't he, that God has heard Sennacherib's mocking words. He says, "It may be," verse 4, "that the Lord your God," again, this rather strange kind of distancing himself, "the Lord your God," again, it's only later that God will break that and bring Hezekiah to himself in direct prayer. But he says here in verse 4, "It may be that the Lord your God," Isaiah, "heard all the words of the Rabshakeh." So there in verse 4, he hopes that God heard Sennacherib's mocking words. He doesn't seem 100% convinced that he has, but he hopes that he has. And then, of course, in verse 16, when Hezekiah does eventually come to prayer himself, as we've just been considering, in verse 16, he beseeches God, doesn't he, to hear Sennacherib's mocking words. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Hear the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to mock the living God. And as then this message comes from Isaiah after the prayer, yes, as we've just been saying, it affirms on the one hand that God has heard Hezekiah's prayer, but it also affirms that God has heard Sennacherib's mocking. Verse 22, this is God himself speaking. And he says, whom have you mocked and reviled? Speaking to Sennacherib. Against whom have you raised your voice and lifted your eyes to the heights? Against the Holy One of Israel. In fact, verses 23 and 24 are then quite interesting. By your messengers you have mocked the Lord and you have said, dot, dot, dot. And here then, we have a whole category of mocking words by Sennacherib, which aren't even on Hezekiah's radar. When Hezekiah talks about Sennacherib's mocking words, he's just talking about what Sennacherib has said through the Rabshakeh outside the walls of Jerusalem. But here there's a whole load of other mocking words that God is saying Sennacherib has uttered. And we'll come in a moment to why that is mockery on the part of Sennacherib in verses 23 and 24. But then you come to verses 27 and 28. But I know you're sitting down, still addressing Sennacherib, God addressing him, and you're going out and coming in, and you're raging against me. Because you have raged against me, and your complacency has come into my ears. And so he goes on. God has heard Sennacherib's mockery. Now, I just want to make a very simple but important point in this connection then. And it's this: God's hearing of Sennacherib's mocking words, that alone settles the outcome of this whole story in 2 Kings 18 and 19. Even if God had no other reason for rescuing Jerusalem from Sennacherib's assault, even if God were actually pretty indifferent toward Hezekiah in Jerusalem, which of course he isn't, they are his special covenant people, but even if he were, Sennacherib has to lose. Jerusalem has to be rescued from his hand, because this man has mocked Yahweh. He has defamed the living God. He has laughed at the idea, chapter 18, verse 35, that Yahweh could possibly deliver Jerusalem from his hand. And God will not allow his glory to be dragged like that through the mud. He won't allow it. And again, there's a biblical principle here, at the very heart, in fact, of the Bible, that's relevant to us this evening. There are many reasons why we as Christians can be assured that one day there will be a new heaven and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. And there will be a multitude that no man can number from every nation, tribe, people and language that inherits that new heaven and new earth where righteousness dwells. There are many reasons why we can be absolutely assured of that tonight. Not least God's love and God's devotion, God's commitment to that multitude that no man can number. But, you know, the bottom line is this. The bottom line is this: Satan has defamed the living God. As we sang in Thomas Kelly's hymn a moment ago, he's the usurper. He has defamed the living God. He has dared to invade God's creation, telling lies about God within God's own backyard, going up to the very statue that God had made of himself within his creation, man, the image bearer, and daring to disfigure that image bearer, as we were considering briefly at the end of this morning's sermon. God will not allow his glory to be dragged like that through the mud. Apart from anything else, without any other consideration, that new heaven and earth is necessary to dismay Satan and to inflict total defeat and total humiliation on this wretched enemy who once dared to defame the glory of the Creator God. So be assured this evening that what the Bible envisages, this great vision of the future that it paints, it must transpire. There must be salvation. There must be the overturning of the fall. The creation must be rescued from Satan's horrible clutches. God has been mocked. And that cannot go unaddressed. And that cannot go unavenged. And I'm saying then that this supremely assuring piece of hearing that we have in our passage tonight is actually this hearing. God hearing the mockery of his enemy. Yes, his mini enemy Sennacherib. But through that we can see God hearing the mockery of his major enemy Satan. And the absolute necessity, therefore, of redemption happening, that God's glory might be vindicated. A hearing that's supernaturally arranged, a hearing that's surprisingly affirmed, a hearing that's supremely assuring. And then fourthly and finally, a hearing that's stupidly absent. A hearing that's stupidly absent. I just flagged up a moment ago verses 23 and 24 of the passage where Sennacherib is quoted at some length. With my many chariots, I have gone up the heights of the mountains, and so on. And what Sennacherib says here is described by God as mockery. Verse 23, by your messengers, you have mocked the Lord, and you have said, with my many chariots, and so on. Now, these are descriptions by Sennacherib of conquests which had indeed occurred. I mean, this man has rampage through the ancient Near East, conquering lots of nations. He's describing here those conquests. And so how is God accusing him there of mockery? We can see that Sennacherib outside Jerusalem saying, Yahweh cannot deliver you from me. We can see that's mockery. But verses 23 and 24, him rehearsing, reciting his various conquests, how is that mockery, I'm asking? Quite a number of years ago now, I was with my brother in London, and one night we were out in London and we were going somewhere by tube, and we were in a bit of a rush, and we were in a particular tube station, and we were just legging it to get on this next train, and we kind of ran down the escalator. As we were doing so, something was being announced on the tannoy. We didn't really listen. We got to the platform at the bottom. The train was there. The doors were open. We rushed in and felt very relieved and very pleased with ourselves. We then kind of looked one way and looked the other way and realized that we were the only people standing on this entire train. Lots of people were standing on the platform looking at us in a rather amused way. And we started to realize this train was not in service and we shouldn't be on it. And so because we hadn't heard something, we hadn't heard that announcement that was being made as we were going down the escalator, because we hadn't heard something, we ended up looking stupid and attracting sniggers from lots of people on the platform. And Isaiah's readers are meant to snigger here at Sennacherib. Because you see, there he is in verses 23 and 24, feeling all pleased with himself for these conquests that he's brought about. Just like my brother and I were pleased with ourselves that we'd made it onto this train. But he hasn't heard something. Verse 25. Have you not heard? He hasn't heard that God, from long ago, as it's put there, has been busy with a plan. And these conquests, which Sennacherib is making such a song and dance about, they have taken place merely because they were part of this divine plan. Nothing to do with Sennacherib's prowess, really. Nothing to do with his military strength and brilliance, really. And so because he hasn't heard something, he's missed the fact that God actually had planned all this before he was even born. Because he hasn't heard something, he ends up looking really rather stupid. By the way, what is this plan of God's? Well, the passage doesn't really tell us, but there is perhaps one little hint in verse 31 where God kind of reaches this climax in the prophecy, the zeal of the Lord will do this. There's only one other time when that phrase is used in the scripture. Well, there are two others, but one is just the verbatim, the same passage as this, in toward the end of Isaiah. But there's one other different passage where this phrase is used. And again, it's a passage that will come up in the next few weeks as we move toward Christmas, Isaiah chapter 9. And you all know what that's about and how Isaiah there foretells this child who's going to be born, whose name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, and about how his government will have no end to it, no limit to it. And Isaiah finishes on that exact same note, the zeal of the Lord of Hosts will do this. Perhaps a hint that that's what Isaiah, the same prophet, is also talking about here. That's the plan. The plan is the installation of a king who will utterly dwarf Sennacherib. And here then is Sennacherib strutting and swaggering and feeling so pleased with himself because of all his conquests, when those conquests are really just one tiny component in a much larger story that he has nothing to do with. The story of God bringing into the world a king who will dwarf all the Sennacheribs of this age. And one other place in the passage then, in the story, where Sennacherib also stupidly fails to hear something. And that's verse 35. And this perhaps is the most famous detail in the whole narrative, this striking down of 185,000 Assyrian soldiers in the middle of the night. It's one of the places, perhaps indeed all the places, where we have that phrase, the angel of the Lord. It's not the most helpful way of translating the phrase. It's certainly not, I think, the most helpful way here. The word angel, it's also the word for messenger, and it's been used as messenger several times in this very passage. Messengers have been quite a key theme, haven't they? Sennacherib sending his messengers to Jerusalem. Verse 23, for instance, by your messengers you have mocked the Lord. And so, you see, the king of Assyria had sent his messengers to Jerusalem to say, Sennacherib is invincible. You need to surrender. But on this night, Yahweh sends his messenger into the Assyrian camp with the message, Yahweh is invincible. You, Sennacherib, need to surrender. The striking down under his nose of 185,000 of his troops, I'm saying, is Yahweh's message to Sennacherib. I'm God, actually. I'm the powerful one, actually. I can do this. This is my message to you, Sennacherib. Just like that, I can wipe out hundreds, thousands of your troops. I'm the one that you need to bow before. I'm God. You need to surrender. Surely, he's got to take that on board. Surely he can't witness 185,000 of his troops being wiped out like that. Surely he can't hear that message from Yahweh to him. I am God. Bow before me, Sennacherib. Surely he can't hear that and ignore it and resist it. And yet that's exactly what he does. He stupidly fails to hear. And what do we read? He at that point goes home, lives in Nineveh. And then verse 37, we read of him worshipping in the house of Yahweh. No, worshipping in the house of Nisroch, his god. Struck me as quite funny in a dark sort of way that I thought be interesting to find out a bit more about Nisroch. I looked up Nisroch in one of my biblical encyclopedia, and all these Babylonian and Assyrian gods, lots of information about many of them. And then it came to Nisroch, and one line, the reference from the Bible here, and then three words, Nisroch is unknown. That was all it said. This, in his Sennacherib, the man who kept asking, where are the gods of such and such? Where are the gods of Hamath? Where are the gods of Sapphira now? And in 2022, we can ask, where, Sennacherib, is the god of Assyria? Where's your Nisroch now? But Yahweh, on the other hand, has millions and millions of worshippers increasingly filling this world. And here then is Sennacherib, and he wouldn't listen to God's message. What a mercy on God's part to send him a messenger that night. He wasn't wiped out like his soldiers were. He had the opportunity to take on board the message and realize that Yahweh is God and bow before him. But he wouldn't do so. He wouldn't listen to God's messenger. And tonight then, I'm God's messenger, not in the same sense that this one was, striking down 185,000 soldiers. But I'm here speaking on God's behalf, preaching to you. And the message with which I'm closing tonight then is that of 1 Thessalonians 1, verses 9 and 10, that you need, if you haven't done so yet, to turn to God from your idols and serve the living and true God and wait then for his Son from heaven. Will you listen to that message tonight? Will you turn from your idols, whatever they are, whatever the modern equivalents of Nisroch are that are capturing your affections tonight, whatever your God is, whatever the thing is that's at the very center of your existence, will you turn from it? You're being given the opportunity, like Sennacherib was, as God's messenger came to him that middle of the night. You're hearing the message this evening. Turn from your gods. Turn to the living God. Will you hear it? Don't go back to your Nisrochs tomorrow morning. But come to the living and true God who has sent his Son to save you from the wrath to come. Bow before him. Surrender your life to him. May God help us all to heed the message. Amen.